It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Hmong pilots flew alongside Americans during the Vietnam War, and only half of them survived the conflict. We'll hear some of their stories. First, in late June 1919, Germany, along with several other European countries, signed the Treaty of Versailles, which officially ended the First World War. While the United States played a smaller role in the conflict than some of those European countries, the war itself still had a tremendous impact on the country. Some 100,000 soldiers died from wounds and illness contracted while abroad. The First World War also reinvigorated the observance of Decoration Day, which we now call Memorial Day. Our next guest joins us to talk about the century that has passed since the official end of the First World War and how the holiday has developed. Kenneth C. Davis joins us now. He's a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Kenneth, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Judith. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real honor to be speaking today with you about this holiday. It's such an important day on our calendar.
And we'll talk about why that is. Let's start by discussing the original roots of what was then called Decoration Day. How did that come about?
Well, the word decoration comes from an order that was issued by a Civil War general who was also a very prominent politician named John Logan. And he said that on May 30th, everyone should go and decorate graves with fresh flowers, the graves of the fallen soldiers from the recent conflict. This was in 1868, of course, 3 years after the war ended. His name is General John Logan, and he was really calling for the nation to honor the memory of those who had died in service to the country, but specifically the Union, because he talked about those who died fighting to save the Union as well as to break the chains of slavery. So this holiday is really born out of the ashes and tremendous loss of the Civil War, but even from its beginnings, it was a little divisive because Southerners in the former Confederacy saw this as a Union or Northern holiday. Thus, they set up their own Confederate Memorial Days or Decoration Days. But it was meant to be a day to go literally to the cemetery and put fresh flowers on the graves of the fallen.
Which I think we still see today, wreaths, flags, other mementos that are put on those graves.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, the most visible and awesome, in a way, sight is the flags in ceremony at Arlington, in which the old guard army in and around Washington go and place a flag at every single one of the graves at Arlington Cemetery. Arlington itself, a vestige of the American Civil War. It was built on land confiscated from Robert E. Lee and his family during the Civil War. The Quartermaster General of the United States of the Union Army decided that it would be fitting to use Robert E. Lee's property as a cemetery for Union soldiers. And so that's why this holiday is so closely associated with so much of the aftermath of the Civil War. But as you mentioned in the intro there, the 100 years ago, the losses in World War I really changed the way people looked at Memorial Day or Decoration Day.
Well, the First World War also really changed the way people looked at war and warfare, I think, as well. What made the First World War unique among, say, modern day combats and conflicts?
Well, let me preface my answer by saying that by the time the 20th century came around, it was 50 years after the Civil War, the United States had been involved with a very short, brief war against Spain that lasted a few months. It did not have anything like the carnage that the country had experienced during the Civil War, when about 2% of the American population died over the course of 4 years of fighting. So people had forgotten how terrible war was in some respects, and the wounds of the Civil War by the early 20th century had been forgotten. World War I changed that. Now, just to refresh everyone's memory here, World War I begins in August of 1914, And the United States wants nothing to do with it. In fact, Woodrow Wilson, the president at the time, campaigns in 1916 as a peace candidate and says he kept us out of war. Wilson did not want the United States to get involved in this conflict between Germany and Austria and the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the allies on the other side, primarily the British, French, the Russians for a period. The Italians were also part of that alliance. So this was truly a world war being fought across Europe, but in many other places around the world. And it was industrial age war, and that's one of the reasons that it was so different. These men had gone off thinking that this would last a few months. They went off on horseback as if they were, you know, fighting the Napoleonic Wars. And of course, this was the era now of tanks, barbed wire, artillery, battleships of the modern age. And in the first few months of this war, 1 million men die in Europe, an astonishing idea. And of course, the war stretches. It's not until 1917 that the United States finally declares war on Germany. And it's almost another year before they actually send troops to Europe. And that time between early the spring of 1918 and the fall of 1918 is still an extraordinary loss of 100,000 American soldiers in a very few months of time, partly complicated by the Spanish flu.
We're talking with Kenneth C. Davis, historian and author, and we are talking about the origins of the Memorial Day holiday. And Kenneth, I want to pause there because you said that the U.S. didn't get involved until fairly late in the war. What brought the United States in at that point?
Well, it were a combination of factors. Of course, Woodrow Wilson, when he speaks to Congress and asks for the declaration of war, talks about making the world safe for democracy. And that's a very high-minded ideal, but it had very little to do with why we actually went to war. The Germans had been attacking U.S. shipping, most famously the sinking of the Lusitania, but that happened in 1915, and still the United States stayed out. But they continued attacks on American commercial shipping. And then more famously or infamously, the Germans tried to get the Mexicans involved with this in this war, allied against the United States. And a very famous piece of diplomatic correspondence called the Zimmermann Telegram was released, in which the Germans were actively trying to court Mexican support. And they had promised that they would give the Mexicans back territory that had been taken in the 19th century. So that was really the final straw that forced Woodrow Wilson's hand in April of 1917 to declare war. Congress took it up quickly. One of the reasons that America was reluctant at the time was that the two largest immigrant groups in America at the time and powerful political forces were first the Germans. There was a large German-American population and Irish. And neither the Germans, who were German-Americans, didn't want a war with their home country of Germany, and the Irish certainly weren't interested in going to war to defend the British. So there was a real political quandary of sorts until finally the German efforts are too much even for Wilson to bear, and he asks for war. The war is declared in April of 17. We spend the best part of a year really getting troops ready. And by May of 1918, 1 million young soldiers, doughboys as they were known, had landed in France.
As we said, some 100,000 Americans died as a result of the First World War. But besides those combat deaths, there were also the effects of combat that were seen when they came home. I'm thinking especially the concept of shell shock that really came into the public awareness after World War One.
That's right. Of course, it was. It's been called other things in other wars. Shell shock was the term from World War One, and it certainly wasn't exclusive to Americans. Soldiers in all of the armies, including the British, experienced this phenomenon, which we would now probably called post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, the same thing. And in World War II, they called it the thousand-mile stare, the thousand-yard stare. So this is, you know, something that's been part of warfare for a long time. Just bringing this very much into the present, the United States Defense Department asked soldiers to and their families to tweet out things for Memorial Day, and what they got was a cascade of complaints about how difficult coming back is, even in these modern times, and the difficulties of what service really means. You know, one of the things that's so important, I think, Judith, on Memorial Day, we are really honoring those, of course, who died in service to the country today. We are honoring those who gave what Abraham Lincoln calls the last full measure of devotion in the Gettysburg Address. But because most Americans have no connection to the military anymore, and even though we have people serving all around the world right now, and many of them in harm's way, we are curiously disconnected, I think, from service and military service in a way we were not, certainly during my father's time when he was in World War I. Many of my friends who went to Vietnam, I was one of the lucky ones because of the lottery, didn't have to go. But we don't have the real connection to what's happening to people who serve, you know, unless we have a neighbor perhaps or know somebody. So this is really something that the country has to contend with much better than we do. And today is a good day to think about that.
As you said, Kenneth, there are these mental and emotional health issues that are nothing new, but certainly are very current in the experience of people coming back from war. Next hour, actually, we'll be talking about how the U.S. military and the VA has dealt with the mental and emotional health of those returning from war. We're talking right now with author and historian Kenneth C. Davis. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. And Kenneth is with us today to talk about the history of Memorial Day as we come up on the 100th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Versailles, which officially ended the First World War. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of Memorial Day? Do you have any family stories from the First World War? How do you observe the Memorial Day holiday? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the end of World War I, a century after it officially ended with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1919. We're also talking about the history of the Memorial Day holiday. Our guest is author and historian Kenneth C. Davis, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you observe Memorial Day? What are some of your takeaways from our conversation so far? And what questions do you have about the holiday? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Kenneth, as we said, it is Memorial Day, and we've discussed a little how Americans established Decoration Day coming out of the Civil War, but how did the First World War kind of reinvigorate that holiday?
Well, the fact is that by the early 20th century, Memorial Day or Decoration Day had become the sort of summer picnic holiday that many people think of it as today, even though it was officially celebrated in most places on May 30th. Now, this was not a national holiday. It was really by proclamation or certain states. But the fact of the losses in 1918 did bring a new spirit of meaningfulness to the holiday. And so the Memorial Day of 1919 marks a new era in the celebration of Decoration Day, not just to focus on the Civil War, but to focus on all those who had given their lives in service to the country. And two very significant aspects of World War I are part of our tradition still. First of all, obviously, the most notable symbol of Memorial Day is probably the Tomb of the Unknown. That was directly related to World War One, and the first unknown was a soldier from World War One, which was known then, of course, as the Great War. It didn't become World War One until much later, after World War Two. So the Tomb of the Unknown is part of this, and a lot of people wonder about poppies, why we have those little poppies, paper poppies, being sold. This is another vestige of World War One. The most famous poem out of World War One begins, "In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below." Written by a Canadian doctor who saw the Flanders field in Belgium, the rows of crosses at this terrible battlefield that had been fought over time and time again during the war. And the poppies were just growing in between the crosses. He was inspired to write this poem. A young American woman reads the poem, decides that poppies are the perfect symbol of loss and remembrance, starts to sell poppies to raise funds for widows and orphans of soldiers, and that becomes known as the poppy movement, and it's still a very meaningful one, not only in the United States, but in England and Canada as well.
Let's go to the phones, and Steve in Tomahawk is up. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I wonder why President Wilson wasn't able to get those 14 points ratified by the Congress and Senate. And if it's true that the war wasn't officially ended until the next president, President Harding, had signed the final document to end the war.
Thanks for that call, Steve.
That's a really good, important question. I wish we had a lot more time for it. Certainly part of it has to do with the fact that President Wilson, a Democrat, was facing a lot of resistance to any of his ideas from a Republican Senate. If that sounds familiar, I suppose it should. Partisanship has always been part of governing in this country. So Wilson had a really hard time selling a lot of the points in the Versailles Treaty, which came out of his famous 14 points, most famously perhaps the League of Nations. Part of the story is interesting, and I talk about this in More Deadly Than War. Wilson got the flu himself, believed to be the Spanish flu, while he was in Paris. His doctor actually thought he'd been poisoned. He was that sick. A lot of people will say that Wilson was not the same after that flu, that his mental capacity, and he was a brilliant man, his reserve, his resolve were considerably weakened by that. And then, of course, a few months later, while he's coming home, while he's back in the United States trying to pitch the Versailles Treaty, he suffers the stroke even more famously. So those there are a lot of factors there, but you have to really begin with the intransigence of the Republican Party to anything that Wilson wanted to do.
Kenneth, you said that this is the most solemn holiday on our national calendar, and yet, you know, as we've mentioned, a lot of people think of it as kind of the official start of summer, a time to barbecue, you know, picnics, things like that. What have we lost in not really thinking about and reflecting on the meaning of Memorial Day?
Well, I think we do a lot better job of it now than even a few years ago. And certainly I grew up, as I mentioned earlier, during the height of the Vietnam War, when Memorial Day, Decoration Day, really kind of fell into a bit of disfavor or, you know, less popularity in this country because people were so divided over the Vietnam War that Memorial Day had lost its fundamental meaning of honoring those who gave their lives in service to the country. Really took the creation of the Vietnam War Memorial in the 1980s and then to a degree the Gulf War in 1991 to bring Memorial Day back as a holiday that the country could make the distinction between honoring those who served and their feelings about the war. So it's been a complicated holiday. Then it's compounded by the fact that Marketing has made every holiday, no matter what holiday it is, a sales opportunity, and that's just modern mass marketing and merchandising. A lot of people will say that when the holiday changed from its original May 30th date to a Monday holiday, which was in 1971, that diminished it a little bit. I'm not sure if that's really the case, but we still do, you know. If you go around the country, I think if you go to small towns, you still see the parade, the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts trooping out to honor those who served at the local cemetery. So it is still a very meaningful ceremony in this country, and I think we're struggling with trying to keep that meaning alive.
Before we let you go, Kenneth, I know that things like World War I, certainly World War II, in countries where the conflict was actually fought on their soil, these conflicts are still very much present for people, whether, you know, they have a personal connection or not. As Americans, we have very fortunately not had a lot of conflicts on our own territory. What should Americans remember and hold on to from the lessons of World War I?
Well, I guess, you know, that makes me think that the most deadly conflict in our history on our soil is still the Civil War, in which more men and more Americans died in the Civil War than all of the other wars put together. So that's why the connection back to the Civil War is extremely significant on this day. When people ask me what to do on Memorial Day, look, we can say Happy Memorial Day because we enjoy the rights and the freedoms and the pursuit of happiness because people did sacrifice for us, and I think we can honor that. One of the best ways to do it is read the Gettysburg Address. It takes about 2.5 minutes. Read it, understand it. Lincoln was speaking about what this holiday ultimately means, that we cannot honor these people any more than what they did honors them, but we must remember that they died for a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it's a really splendid way to end this day, I think.
Well, Kenneth, thank you so much for spending time with us. We often have you on holidays, and you always really bring a lot more meaning to the holiday. So thank you for that.
It's my great pleasure, and as I said, an honor. I think it's a really important thing that we connect to this past and bring it to our present. We don't have enough civic engagement, and understanding this sacrifice, I think, helps us get a little bit more interested in making sure we do the right thing. Thank you, Judith, and you should have a happy holiday.
Thank you, Kenneth, to you too. Kenneth C. Davis is a historian and author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the author of a book that documents the experiences of Hmong pilots during the Vietnam War. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about why some believe that Wisconsin could see near-record turnout in next year's presidential election. First, the role of Hmong pilots in the Vietnam War has not been well known by the general public. But the sacrifices of those who served in support of U.S. troops is now told in their own words in a book titled Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War. Author Chia Yu Yi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also Associate Vice Chancellor for Global Inclusion and Engagement and is the director of UWM's Hmong Diaspora Studies Program. Central Time host Rob Ferret spoke with her last month.
Well, set the stage for us. How did Hmong pilots come to fly on behalf of the American side in the Vietnam War, or as you write, they called it in Asia, the American War?
Absolutely. Well, you know, during the Vietnam War, most of the activities actually took place in Vietnam, but because of the Vietnam and Laos sharing a border, Laos became one of the locations where the United States implemented covert operations. I mean, we did that all over the world, but Laos was one of the biggest operations during the parallel to the Vietnam War. So the air war was, you know, happening in mass volume in Southeast Asia, but so many of the, you know, planes like B-52s and these wonderful fighter jets, they could bomb from really far up in the air, but what the ground troops needed was the close air support. So to make that happen, the United States secretly trained a few dozen Hmong pilots, and it wasn't just Hmong pilots. You know, Lao and Cambodian and Vietnamese pilots trained as well. But for this particular operation, it was called water pump, because Laos was a neutral country. The United States, you know, the U.S. Air Force working in collaboration with the CIA, would bring these ethnic minority men from Laos to Thailand to train to become these fighter pilots. So that's how we became involved. I say we because, you know, I was a child at the time. People have heard about Hmong soldiers, but most people have never heard about this Hmong people being fighter pilots. So that's what my book is about, tells that story, because it was a, you know, many things were classified until the 1990s. So you began to have the CIA, you know, officials who work with Hmong, U.S. Air Force, and also many American pilots who flew with them in Laos beginning to acknowledge that they actually had worked with these pilots.
Now, you write that initially some of the trainers, the American trainers, were very skeptical. One referred to the Hmong trainees as hillbillies. They didn't think they'd be able to handle flying. Can you talk about that training process and how these Hmong pilots overcame that skepticism from the Americans involved?
Sure. So over the course of their history or our history, the Hmong people were, you know, ethnic minorities who mostly lived on the what I call the fringes of these societies in the mountainous regions. So most people didn't, you know, have access to education during the French era. You know, a few people went to school. So few people had an education. So the idea or the perception or the characterization of Hmong people has always been they were primitive, they're backwards, they don't know much about technology or modern society. And so when the CIA officials were thinking about allowing Hmong to fly, there was a tremendous resistance from American military and civilian leaders that, oh, you can't train these, you know, hillbillies, not my term, but their term, mm-hmm. Or primitive people who, I mean, some of the stereotypes are that, oh, these are people you're taking off the backs of buffalo one day and putting them on the plane. So there's all these stereotypes about Hmong. You know, and some of the, you know, ethnic Lao leaders didn't think the Hmong could fly too. So there was a lot of resistance. But because of the nature of the war and because of the nature of the Hmong, or in particular General Vang Pao, who, you know, worked directly with the CIA, he was a, you know, as many people may already know this, he was the Hmong military officer who was part of the Royal Lao Army. But he also worked directly with the CIA. And so because of that close relationship, he was able to convince the CIA officials to let a few Hmong begin to train. And then the Hmong men did really well. They all were not men who were taken off the back of buffalo, just to be clear. All of the men who were selected to train as pilots actually had an average of middle school education. So they were sort of, at the time, the elite of Hmong society. They went to school. They were, you know, several have degrees from the National University of Laos or the teacher training school. So there was resistance, and it was really hard because they had to learn English, and because the language in the air is English. So the men had to overcome a lot of barriers in terms of being an ethnic minority group that people felt weren't suitable to fly these modern planes, but then also to overcome all kinds of ethnic animosity and I think racism as well. They overcame all of that and succeeded in several dozen that completed T-28 training.
We're talking to Chia Yuyi Vong from UW-Milwaukee about her new book. It's called Fly Until You Die, An Oral History of Hmong Pilots in the Vietnam War. And as you mentioned a little while ago, many of these pilots did die, 50% mortality rates, you mentioned. One of those pilots who died in the course of duty was Tao Zhang Li. Can you share his story with us?
Sure. It's Tao Zhang Li. He's, one of the T-20 pilots, and, you know, his aircraft crashed, and so he died. And what's really interesting is that you would have a small cohort that would train, and then they would come back to work. And because of the high casualty, before the next group would finish training, most of the group that came before them had passed away, right? So Du Xiong was an individual who was killed in action, and very interestingly, you know, he left his wife and children. And when I was interviewing, most of these pilots, you know, when they died, their parents and family suffered greatly. Whereas before, they received financial benefits for being pilots. The families lived much better than other Hmong families at the time. But once the pilots die, you know, the funds start coming, and people then have to struggle on their own. So a really beautiful story. As I went around the country to interview the surviving pilots, I actually was trying to interview his younger brother, who is still so, you know, the pain is still very real for him. His younger brother lives in Michigan. And so I went to visit him and then had an opportunity to talk with his son, who was 10 at the time when Du Xiong was killed. And after I finished interviewing the two of them, his brother, Du Xiong's brother, said, "Well, my mother is still here. Would you like to talk to her?" I didn't know that. And I said, yes, please, you know, let me talk to her. So very long story short, one of the most heart-wrenching stories of the book is about my interview with her and, you know, just her love for her son and the sacrifices that she's made as a result of, you know, having her son pay the ultimate price, right? So he died, and she raised his children, and they all moved to the United States. But for her, the most difficult part was being a mother, like many other mothers, too, that I didn't get to interview, but I've heard from family members. You know, mothers, you know, she lost her son, and so she talks about how every day, you know, since he passed away nearly, you know, more than 40 years ago, the pain is still real. Every time she hears a plane here in the U.S., she thinks about him, and, you know, any recollection of, you know, the old country just brings the pain back. And so, you know, that was really hard for me to listen to that.
And you also talked to some of the pilots who survived the war and ended up here in the United States. How did they talk about that experience looking back?
Well, a lot of the pilots, as I mentioned, several of them lived in areas with large Hmong populations, so they have been involved in various Hmong veterans initiatives. But for the majority of them, they came to the United States, and what they did was a lot of these pilots, again, at the time, it was such a dangerous task, but they were indeed the most wealthy in terms of Hmong society because they received pay from the, you know, the Army as well as the CIA. So they lived good lives for the short time that they, you know, did enjoy that. But when the war ended and they were forced into exile, many of these pilots, in fact, just wanted to forget about that part of their life and just to move on and to rebuild their lives. So for several of them, being asked to think about that experience, in many ways they talk about how healing the process is. It's very painful to remember, because they have tried to forget for so many years. But now that they're able to remember and to make sense of that particular time, as well as what happened to themselves, their friends, and all of the Hmong people who became refugees after the war, it was a healing process for them. But at the same time, it brings back a lot of pain and anger as well, because they know now more than they did back then. Back then, they thought the war was about something different, and then once they get to this country, they better understood the larger geopolitical issues, and that brought some anger into some of the pilots who spoke. And war brings out some of the worst in people. So some of them were very critical of not just American, you know, policymakers and military leaders about the decisions they made, but also the internal political dynamics that happened within the Hmong army. So lots of conflicts there. For example, some of the pilots who were injured but not killed, once they're injured, you know, they're no longer useful to the army. And so it's almost as if they're dead. They're not acknowledged anymore. So that's very painful for several of them. And it comes out really clear in the interviews with them and some of the stories I recount in the book.
Chia, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing their stories with us.
Thank you so much.
Chia Yuyi Vang is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Her book is Fly Until You Die, an oral history of Hmong pilots in the Vietnam War. She spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret last month. Coming up, could Wisconsin see 75% voter turnout in next year's election? It might be possible thanks to a variety of factors. We'll look at those in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about the history of amusement parks from the Middle Ages to the present day. First, we're still more than a year away from the next presidential election, but that's not stopping anyone from speculating about what might happen. One area that's of particular interest to political observers is what voter turnout might look like. With a polarizing president in office and Wisconsin's status as a battleground state, some believe we could see near record or record turnout in next November's election. Craig Gilbert joins us now to talk about the factors that could drive turnout next year. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he also writes the Wisconsin Vote blog. His recent piece is called Wisconsin Voter Turnout Could Go Through the Roof in 2020. Craig, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Well, let's cut to the chase. How much of all of this boils down to how people feel about President Trump?
Well, that's certainly a big factor when you look at how engaged and interested people are in politics, because President Trump inspires very strong passions from both his supporters and his opponents. And so people are, when you look at the opinion polls, they're a very sizable portion of the electorate, in some cases as much as half, says they definitely will vote against him. Almost half say they strongly disapprove of his presidency. On the other side, he's got a very large core, hardcore support. It's not as big, I would say, right now as the hardcore of opposition, but he's got a very passionate core, and it's likely that he's going to drive a lot of those people to the polls next year, and a lot of people are going to come out to vote against him as well.
Well, let's back up to last fall's 2018 midterm elections. Now, in general, midterms aren't exactly known for being turnout barn burners, but what kind of numbers did we see here in Wisconsin then?
Well, nationally, we saw the biggest turnout in about 100 years, or more than 100 years. It was over 50%. In Wisconsin, about 62% of the people that could legally voted, which was also a turnout record in the post-war era for a midterm. And kind of the obvious explanation for that, again, is President Trump. The people are very fired up on both sides, and you saw that. You saw that in the midterm especially, but you also saw it even in a nonpartisan race, the race we had for state Supreme Court in April, which was one of the highest turnouts we've had for an April election.
So are these outliers, or have we seen a trend that's been building and now we're hitting, you know, those high marks that people are paying attention to?
Well, I don't think they're outliers. I think they're very high numbers, but I think they tell you something about the political climate in the Trump presidency. When you look at the history of presidential turnout in Wisconsin, I would say it's been pretty high over the last 20 years or so, but there have been some ups and downs. I mean, the modern turnout record for Wisconsin was in 2004, the Bush-Kerry election, where you also had a polarizing Republican president running for re-election. And you also had an election that came on the heels of a very close presidential election 4 years earlier. In this case, we're talking about 2000, where you had a split outcome between the Electoral College and the popular vote. And I think that kind of feeds a sense on the part of voters when you have close races like that, that their vote matters. And also when you have, you know, the Electoral College going one way and the popular vote going another way. And in Wisconsin, in all these cases, you've had very close races. You had one in 2000, you had one in 2004, and you had one in 2016.
So looking back, it seems like there are quite a few commonalities between now and that 2004 election that you talked about. What are some lessons or indications that people should be taking from the 2004 example that might hold true now, too?
Well, so what's really interesting about 2004 is you had, you know, almost 75% of eligible voters voting, which, again, is a level that only one other state has ever exceeded, which is Minnesota has done it a few times. No other states have had a turnout that high in any presidential election year in modern times. So the second question that everybody, I think, is interested in when you talk about high turnout is what does it mean for the Democrats and the Republicans? Does it make it more likely or less likely that President Trump is going to get reelected? The conventional wisdom for a long time has been generally that high turnout helps Democrats because a lot of votes, a lot of groups that tend to vote Democratic, young voters in particular, or some minority voters, tend to have lower turnout in general. And so a high turnout usually means that those groups are increasing their turnout, and that can help Democrats. But what we saw in 2004 was we had this super high turnout and we had this super close election. So it wasn't as simple as super high turnout was helpful to Democrats. Democrats did win Wisconsin in 2004, but by a very, very slim margin. So that's a wild card. You know, if we do have high turnout, you know, will it favor one side over the other?
We're talking with Craig Gilbert. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about his recent piece, which is Wisconsin voter turnout could go through the roof in 2020. And one thing that just as we've been talking, Craig, I was thinking about is, do we see a significant difference in voter turnout, whether it's a presidential position that's up for grabs, as in, you know, a president is not running for re-election, the sitting president is not running for re-election, or whether it's, you know, after one term and that president is running again? Does that matter?
Well, I think when you have a president running for re-election in a tight re-election, that can be very motivating for people, especially in our polarized time. So that's one of the parallels with President Bush in 2004. Now, there was a very different set of circumstances that I think was driving up passions in 2004. It was the first election after 9/11, and you had the Iraq War going on, which really kind of raised the political temperature across the country. In this case, you know, we're not at war. In fact, we also have a pretty good economy. Often a bad economy drives up turnout. So those conditions aren't present. But again, you have a very supercharged political atmosphere because of emotions around President Trump. Things could happen in the world that could also feed into that between now and November of 2020.
So we've talked about the economy. We've talked about a very polarizing president. Are there other issues that could cause voters to head to the polls or make them stay home?
Well, one thing that it's not so much an issue, it's just sort of a set of political conditions, which is by every indication, Wisconsin is going to be, let's say, a top five target among the 50 states in this presidential race. I think any political commentator would tell you that. That's another parallel with 2004. And that, again, sort of feeds this sense on the part of voters that their votes matter, their state matters. But it also means that both sides are pouring in incredible resources into not only both persuading voters, but also driving voters to the polls. So that's another very important ingredient. When money is being spent by both sides to organize, to identify their potential supporters, to get them to the polls, when you have the airwaves saturated with television ads, it feeds that sense. When you have the candidates coming into Wisconsin, all those conditions were present in 2004, and I think that really is the best explanation for why turnout was through the roof, was record-setting in 2004. That could all happen again in 2016. We've seen the Democrats they're going to hold their convention in Milwaukee, their national convention next year. We've seen Donald Trump already returning to this state, and Democrats, of course, are not going to want to repeat the mistake that Hillary Clinton made last time of taking the state for granted and not even coming here.
We're already seeing numerous presidential hopefuls making stops in the state, and there will be their representatives coming as well. Does that have a real impact on voter turnout? I know the fact that Hillary Clinton did not come here has been pointed to as a reason why she lost Wisconsin narrowly to Donald Trump. But overall, do people care? Does that really drive them to vote or who to vote for?
Well, usually the candidate travel goes hand in hand with the other things that the campaign is doing. So, you know, whether the fact that she didn't campaign here hurt her, I mean, it had to hurt her on some level. There's a reason the candidates campaign in the states that they've identified as political priorities, but it's also kind of symptomatic of the overall level of effort that a campaign is making in a state. And the Democrats didn't really do that in 2016. I mean, the Republicans didn't pour a lot of money into organizing Wisconsin either. I mean, Donald Trump had kind of a disorganized campaign. He's going to have a much more organized campaign as the incumbent. So there's going to be a much, I think, stronger ground game on both sides in 2020 than there was in 2016. 2016 turned out to be super close, but that wasn't the expectation, so you didn't have the commensurate political effort being made. Going into the 2020 cycle, everybody sees this state as being up in the air, up for grabs, super close, so you're going to see a much higher level of effort, and that is going to drive up the vote.
Craig, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he also writes the Wisconsin Vote blog. We were speaking with him about his recent piece. That piece is called Wisconsin Voter Turnout Could Go Through the Roof in 2020. Last week, I interviewed two Wisconsin students, 10-year-old Maya Jadiv and 8-year-old Aiden Wijaya Kulasuria. Both are representing Wisconsin in this week's Scripps National Spelling Bee. I gave each of them a word to spell, which they nailed. Aiden got umlaut and Maya got escargot. Then I gave them the chance to ask me to spell a word. Maya went with ricetoffel, which I got wrong because I didn't know about the silent J. Then Aiden decided to give me the hardest word he could think of. He said it was the hardest word. It was, well, let's let Aiden tell us.
Pneumonolithomicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis.
So, needless to say, I didn't even try. According to the Oxford Dictionary, it's a 45-letter invented long word said to mean a lung disease caused by inhaling very fine ash and sand dust. After we finished the interview, I asked Aiden if he could spell pneumonolithomicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis, and here he is.
P-N-E-U-M-O-N-O-U. Pneumonolithomicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis.